Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
One of the reasons why people don't catch other people lying is that the other person has convinced themselves, the liar has convinced themselves of the truth of what they're saying.
In the previous two episodes of IDN with Clark Freshman, we've looked at how to catch those unintentional expressions of emotion that may flash fleetingly across someone's face in stressful situations, such as a dispute negotiation. But what about looking at this from the other end of things? Putting aside for the moment the ethics of lying, what if your goal is to avoid any expression of emotion that might hint that you're not entirely comfortable with what you yourself are saying? In other words, can you convey a false or inaccurate version of reality without your emotions betraying you? You can, as Clark points out in this third and final episode, but in order to bypass the human brain's capacity to express and perceive emotion, you'll need to do one of three things. You can occupy a position of power so great that it doesn't really matter to you whether the other side believes what you're saying. You can instruct someone else to do the negotiating for you and give them erroneous or misleading information to act upon. Or you can practice the art of self-deception, convincing your conscious self that your version of events is, in fact, the truth. This last category is perhaps the most insidious because we become both the deceiver and the deceived. And as Clark points out, it's also easy, because self-deception is part of the way our brains naturally function.
So we think of memory as being something that is perfect, and then we just find it, like putting something in a vault, and then we take it out of the vault, and it's in the same condition we put it in. But memory research shows that every time you retell a story, you're actually changing it and then saving it in a different way, like saving a different version of a document. So let's take the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas situation. Anita Hill tells a story about an event that occurred many years ago.
By the way, just for the sake of listeners who are not in the U.S., you should explain that
yes.
Clarence Thomas was a Supreme Court justice candidate who had to be confirmed by the United States Senate. And Anita Hill,
who worked for him, and she recalled several inappropriate incidents that in the U.S. would be viewed as sexual harassment, and even elsewhere would be viewed as inappropriate.
I think most places, the things that she was saying is that, you know, he made derogatory or sexual type of comments and innuendo. I think in most countries would be considered, if they were true, to be a form of sexual harassment.
Right. So the question was, did he actually say these things or not? She testifies before the Senate, which has to confirm him, and she showed no signs of deception. She spoke very clearly. She spoke very consistently. So there was no change when she recalled certain incidents compared to the way she ordinarily acts. Second, she didn't have any expressions of emotion as she was speaking that were inappropriate. No kinds of fear, no kinds of contempt, no kinds of disgust. That's not always there, but we know 70% of the time when someone is lying, they either show disgust or they show fear. So we know that statistically. Well, why might it be that she didn't have this? It could be everything she said occurred exactly as she was reporting. And that's very possible. We know from memory when there is an intense incident that people remember it quite well. So that's very possible. She was telling the truth. But another possibility is that she had retold the story so many times, each time slightly exaggerating the incident, that by the time she was speaking to the Senate, it was as if it was true, according to her. Same thing with Clarence Thomas, with a slight twist. Clarence Thomas didn't appear calm. He became quite angry and attacked the Senate and said that it was a high-tech lynching. Now, that's a bit of a red flag. When someone goes on the attack, that could be a way of deflecting the accusation itself. Doesn't mean that Clarence Thomas was lying, but it's more suspicious than what Anita Hill did. So he could have been lying, or it could be that he became so angry because he really believed at that moment that what she said was an exaggeration or not even true. And we can think of that as being a kind of self-deception.
So both of them thought that they were telling the truth.
Both of them could have thought they were telling the truth.
From the point of view of somebody who's an expert in lie detection, you don't see any obvious signs that either one of them appears to be lying.
No obvious signs. There's more suspicion with Clarence Thomas that he was lying because of the way in which he went on the attack. But if it were completely untrue, that would also be a possibility.
Okay, but you don't see the different lie detection is facial expressions and body language didn't contradict the things that he was saying.
That's correct. There was no contradiction there. Right. So in that sense, we didn't get anything clear from what he said.
What is interesting to me in some of the research that Paul Ekman has done is not just that people leak this information. We discussed last time that you were on IDN this notion of leakages, that people leak information through their facial movements, through their body language, but that these leakages are subconsciously or they're perceived by parties, by the other side, who may not understand why it is that they're getting the feelings that they get, but it's a form of communication that seems to go on below the normal level of discourse that takes place outside the words that are spoken. So it seems to me if you really wanted to deceive someone, the best way to deceive them is to first deceive yourself. Because then not only are you going to not leak this sort of information, but you're actually going to convey sincerity and they may actually be convinced that, maybe you're right.
Well, that's a very good point. There's also some other new unpublished research by Dana Carney, who's a Columbia Business School professor and was a protege of the late Maureen O'Sullivan, who did a lot of the groundbreaking research with Paul Ekman on liars and who are the best people at detecting lies, the so-called Wizard Project. What Dana found was that people who are in more powerful positions are less likely to leak signs of deception. So it's not merely that people are convincing themselves factually that it's correct that can allow people to be more successful liars. It's that they believe they're more powerful and perhaps more entitled, and therefore there's less leakage.
What's the theory for why that would be? Why would people in power have less leakage?
If we look at it not from the point of view of who's more powerful, but who's less powerful, so let's ask the question, why are people less powerful more likely to leak out behaviors? We only have a certain amount of bandwidth. So just like a computer, where if you open too many windows, it'll start to slow down. If we are attending to too many emotional or cognitive tasks, we'll slow down. The microexpressions come out because the cognitive parts of the brain are less able to clamp down on the emotion, and or because the emotion is stronger. If someone's less powerful, they may be more anxious generally, and therefore that gives them less bandwidth to be able to clamp down on the emotion.
Clark, but they may also feel that they have more to lose, right? They may be more stressed by the situation. I mean, somebody who's powerful may also be in a position where they can say, look, tell the truth, not tell the truth, but at the end of the day, this is not going to change my life terribly much, and so it may have less meaning to them, whereas somebody who's in a less powerful situation and in a significant negotiation may really feel that this is everything they've got.
Excellent. That's correct. So let's say we're doing something as simple as a job interview and someone's being interviewed. The person interviewing, especially in today's job market, they may have very low anxiety at all. In fact, they may have positive emotion, being impressed that there are so many good candidates who are there. On the other side of the table, the person may have little positive emotion and they may have a lot of negative emotion because they know there are many applicants and they know that there are not that many other jobs. That person with the less power is so taxed that if they try to lie, it's going to be more likely to leak out. And that, by the way, is a good scenario to apply lie detection because we know from research that 30 to 50% of the time, resumes have some sort of factual misstatement on there.
But it seems to me there are two populations here, right? There is one population of people who truly believe that they're right. And if they truly believe that they're right, then they're not going to show any signs of telling lies because they actually, it's like, I look out the window today and I see that the sky is blue. I say the sky is blue. But if I could take it to some point in a dispute and say, well, I was there and I saw this. And the other side may say, well, no, I was there too. And I saw something completely different. It's your point about memory being malleable at the end of the day. So it seems to me like there's one population there. There's not a lot of value of trying to figure out if they're lying. If really they're not lying, they're just saying things that are inaccurate, but they believe these inaccuracies. But there's another group to be careful about the powerful.
You're correct that there is one group of people where it's hard to catch them because it's just a matter of perception, and their perception is as good as any other. Part of the reason why people may believe what they're saying is because it's the only information that we have, that they have. So when I gave a presentation to a very large New York law firm, one of the senior partners came up and said, I feel very justified now in what I do. When I tell a junior partner or an associate how much settlement authority they have, I always lie to them. And I don't give them all of the information in a conscious attempt to not let the other side get the information. And I won't meet with the other side. And I don't like the principal witnesses to meet with the other side.
Really? So managing, this has actually led at least one person to limit the amount of information being given to the people who are doing the actual negotiating so that they will, in a sense, self-deceive.
That's correct. Well, they're not quite self-deceived. They're deceived.
They're not self-deceived. Yeah. Exactly. They're not self-deceived, but they are deceived. So, but they will go into the negotiation believing that their position and their authority, the client's authority, is only a maximum of X, when in fact it may be higher. It may be Y and even Z.
That's correct. Or if we use the political context, the same thing with diplomats and other negotiators. During the Bush administration, one of the press secretaries maintained that there was certain information about weapons of mass destruction. And then later, when he was no longer in office, said that that was what he had been told, that he had actually been given false information. If we look at the run-up to the Iraq invasion, some people would say, certainly General Powell maintains, that he did not get the correct information. And that could have been a deliberate attempt to make him seem
more credible when he went to speak to the United Nations.
Especially because he already had so much international credibility.
Right.
So that's a very complicated
strategy. I guess a cynical interpretation of that would be to feed him misinformation so that when he goes and speaks to the United Nations, he'll be as credible as possible because he'll actually believe the information on which he's basing the opinions that he's saying.
Yes, that's correct. Another group of people who do this are people who represent people before tax authorities. So I was interviewing some very prominent lawyers who represent people in major tax audits. And they say that they routinely tell people, don't tell me certain things. I don't want to know them. White-collar criminal defense lawyers, in a book where they were studied, they routinely tell their clients in the beginning, don't feel that you need to tell me everything. It may not actually help your case for that to be true. So it's a matter of people being able to lie better because they don't actually know the information. Sometimes they're manipulated from above, and sometimes they're manipulated from below. So sometimes one person is not telling the person representing them all of the truth, and sometimes the representative is saying, I don't actually want to know something that will make me feel less confident or that I might betray inadvertently to the other side.
So people actually think about this stuff and even plan for it.
Some people do. Most people do not, but some people do. And the question that's always arisen in this area of deception research is, can one, in technical terms, develop countermeasures? So if somebody wants to be a successful liar, is that possible?
Right. So, but what's interesting to me, though, is that there's a recognition that there are these limitations in ourselves and our ability to control leakage, to prevent leakage. And so we send others to do battle for us, giving them false information or inaccurate information so that they will, in effect, become our effective liars.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Right.
Sounds very deceptive and manipulative.
Right. And probably a long history in politics and history as well.
Yeah. You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.